If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
And your company, you know, what served you well, you know, again, I tell people this, you know, what served you well when you were at 1,000 door may not serve you well at 3,000 doors. And what served you well at 3,000 door probably is not going to serve you the same at 5,000 doors.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Hey, John, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Thanks for coming on today. Certainly appreciate it. Can you give our listeners just a quick bio on yourself?
John Azar. I'm a managing partner and founder of Peak 15 Capital and also a managing member of Mac Venture Partners. Peak 15 Capital is a capital advisory platform as well as a syndicator and co-sponsor of multifamily assets. And Mac Venture Partners is the same, except we don't, at Mac Venture Partners, my other firms, we don't really place equity for sponsors. We've been a sponsor owner operator in the Southeast, focused only in the Southeast for the past better part of over 11 years, and have owned and operated over 6,500 doors. But we've been in that company, we've been a net seller for the past year and a half or so. So we've reduced our footprint by a good amount in the past couple of years, down about 5,000 doors or so in the Southeast.
Wow. Wow. That's a lot to cover. I'm excited to jump into the show. The basic flow of the show that we, and the same questions I ask everybody who comes on is, where'd you start? Where are you now? And how did you get there?
Yeah. Yeah, sure. I guess my start and passion in for commercial real estate probably started many years before I even got into multifamily, got into real estate, commercial real estate from in a structured finance company that I launched with some partners of mine from the equity world. I used to work with them on the equity desk at Morgan Stanley, and we started the company called Boston Venture Partners. And, that was back in 04, 05, 06. And we did projects that were mainly conversion projects, either hotel conversion projects or, you know, hospitality conversion projects or something else. It was most of our projects were urban reuse projects. So we worked on conversions of large buildings that used to be, you know, something else. Most of our focus were major metros like Boston, New York, Philadelphia. And those cities had a lot of urban reuse projects that were large. So that's how I got started. And we structured deals in Boston for, you know, luxury condo developments. We structured deals in Philadelphia, you know, waterfront for also, you know, condo developments. So we had a few deals until about 2008 when the crap hit the fan and we had to play the Irish jigsaw, you know, and we had to close shop and, all of us had to rethink and retool and kind of reinvent ourselves at that point. And then really, you know, take it fast forward until about 2014, I joined my brother, who was the CEO and founder of Mac Venture Partners, in growing the company and taking it to the next level. And we worked on Mac Venture Partners from about, again, 2014, 2015 until about 2019, 20, as that's when we sort of hit our stride and we had about 6,500 doors. But then we started selling towards the end. Our last deal at Mac Venture Partners was was in end of 2019. And we've been selling since then on that side of the firm. So we've been a sort of a net seller for the past couple of years. But on, yeah, and then 2019, I launched Peak 15 Capital right around the same time, right before COVID. And then as COVID hit, we were trying to find our stride and you know, sort of retool the company and launch it in an effective and impactful way. And we had lots of clients that were mostly sponsors that were looking for capital at the time. And we still do. Obviously, that's our bread and butter is working and helping sponsors and syndicators find equity capital for their deals. And it's been a great ride in all the things that I've done for the past, I don't know, I'm going to age myself, last 20 years or so.
Wow. Okay. So we need more than 15 minutes, but I look forward to jumping in here on a few of these things.
That's about as compressed as I've talked about my bio in a long time. That's my record for going through my bio.
Yeah, and well done, because there's so much here. I really want to find out. In 2008, you said you guys had to close shop. Did you go bust?
Yeah, the company went bust. I mean, we lost all our clients overnight. We had several developer and investor, institutional investor client, developer clients that were based out of big cities like New York or somewhere even out of the country like London. And literally overnight, our client base dried up. Everybody pulled out a project and, you know, it was the commercial real estate space was a ghost town. We, you know, had zero revenue, zero clients. And we just had to, you know, yeah. I mean, pretty much. I mean, we didn't close shop per se, but we had to stop operations.
Wow. What are some lessons you learned through that?
Lots of lessons. Don't count your eggs before they hatch, essentially. So I think we were all on a great ride, and we thought the ride would never end. And as many people thought at that time, and we acted like it. We acted like, oh, things are okay. That things are just it's just a blip, or it's just some noise in the marketplace that'll never materialize into anything substantial. But it did. And not only did it materialize into something substantial, it changed the facet of the economy for the foreseeable 3 to 4 years after that.
Wow. Was there anything you could have done to protect yourself in that?
Yeah, I mean, we could have hedged, I guess, we were all in on commercial real estate, and that's what took the biggest hit. I mean, so I don't know how we could have hedged in that per se. Maybe we could have, I mean, in hindsight, looking at it now, maybe we could have started getting into, you know, multifamily or buying in multifamily at the time, which my brother started doing in fortuitously in 2008. So at the time that I was sort of closing shop and closing the book on one chapter of one of my companies, my brother was launching the new iteration of what was to become Mac Venture Partners.
Right. Oh, that's fascinating. Wow. Those are, do you see any similarities, to kind of the period we're in now? I mean, I know 2020 was a weird year for everyone, but did any of that come back as like, oh, hey, I've seen this before, or is this just a different animal altogether?
I think it's a different animal altogether. I don't think we have the same mechanics as we had in 2008 going into this. 2008, everybody was leveraged to the hilt. Leverage was the name of the game back then. And, that's not the same now. I mean, people are very, leery of leverage, especially over leverage. There's a lot of cash on the sideline right now, which did not happen in 2008. A ton of cash, a ton of capital, ton of liquidity that is hungry to put into deals. That again was not the case in 2008. 2008 was people had a lot less liquidity. There was not a whole lot of cash on the sideline, not a lot of trepidations into sort of leverage and what leverage could do. So certainly there are some lessons out of 2008 that people have learned and maintained and retained and have prepared themselves better this time around. Are we going to see a pullback in the market or some kind of a correction? Sure. I just don't think we're not going to be anywhere near 2008, especially coming out of COVID right now, as we've been seeing. I mean, we are coming out of a very precarious economic times in the world, not just in this country. The whole world got affected by COVID. But in this country in particular, we are coming out of one of the biggest, sort of social and economic dry spells that we've had in our history, maybe, it's funny because, it's not funny, but having an economic and a social dry spell, hit a country or hit the world at the same time I don't think has ever happened. Mm-hmm. Where people socially and economically have been affected and even psychologically, to be honest. So, and I think we're coming into a time where, like any times that a country or an economy comes out of something very harsh and very hard to go through, we're going to be coming into some kind of a boom time at some point in the next year or 2 years or so. Whether that happens in 6 months or 12 months, it will happen. And I think we're going to see some tremendous buying opportunities. And I think we're probably going to see some very, very interesting capital, you know, moving around in the next couple of years.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. Yeah, I think it'll be very interesting to see where all this money that we've printed goes and into what asset classes it hides.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Mac Venture Partners. I love the fact that you guys grew. I mean, 6,500 doors, that's a big operation. And so talk to us a little bit, one, with the growth, you know, what it looked like to grow a company to that size, kind of some of the, you know, lessons learned along the way, things you did right, things you did wrong, maybe some things you'd want to do differently. And then I want to hear on the back end of that, why you guys are now net sellers.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, to grow any company to grow they have to retool internally more so than externally. As I tell people all the time that the growth of a company is always dictated about what you do internally with yourself and your processes and your people, more so than what you outwardly do to people that you deal with, because people that you deal with on the outside are going to see and realize what you've done on the inside through your dealings with them. And they're going to find out really quick whether you're a company that's worth pursuing or not. So the first thing you know, we had to do is really kind of retool ourselves on the inside and be prepared for every stage and every sort of, you know, inflection point in our growth. And that those inflection points come in different cycles and different stages for every company. And especially in our state and in multifamily, you know, when you hit 1500 doors, you have an inflection point. When you hit 2000 doors or 2500 doors, you have a different inflection point. When you have 3000 or 4000 or 5000 and so on and so forth. So it's, you know, it's different inflection point. And your company, you know, what served you well, you know, again, I tell people this, you know, what served you well when you were at 1000 door may not serve you well at 3000 door. Mm-hmm. And what served you well at 3000 door probably is not going to serve you the same at 5000 doors. So just because something worked for you up until a certain stage of your evolution doesn't mean it's going to continue to work for you in your future stage of evolutions. You know, it's just one thing to be aware that, hey, you know, you constantly have to rethink and retool yourself to be prepared to be a better you know, or a bigger you in the future.
Yeah, I like what you said there about, you know, what you do internally will obviously attract people to you on the external that see what you've done and go, hey, I want to work with them. So why did you guys then transition? You know, you made it to 6,500 doors. The name of this game, obviously, or a lot of the name of this game is cash flow. We buy for cash flow, at least a lot of us do. But now you're selling. Why are you selling?
We have a couple of reasons. We thought in 2019, we recognized that the market was pretty on fire, you know, I guess put it mildly. And the buying opportunities were not penciling in. We're historically have been a very, very conservative shop, and our underwriting and our numbers and our projections and projects just weren't penciling in. And, you know, we have another company that we're, you know, integrated, which is our property management company. And we wanted to sort of grow that property management company. So we kind of took a step back from the acquisition cycle and try to grow the property management company to become more than just a you know, in-house property management company. Maybe at some point make it a third party management company. And that's my brother Tony's sort of baby along with his family to try to grow that side of the business and make it into a recognizable entity as far as a property management company. So we, you know, if you are going to concentrate on growing one side of your company as opposed to another side, something's going to give. So you're going to have to, you can't serve multiple masters all the time. You know, that's not going to serve you well. So something had to give, and we had to rethink of the sort of the acquisition strategy and, you know, whether it's right or wrong, we decided to sort of become a net seller and take some chips off the table and see where, you know, the world will end up in 2021, 2022. At that point, maybe, you know, anything is possible.
Right, right. And I think that's a very interesting transition because, you know, kind of like you said, one, you get to take chips off the table, but two, you get to build a business that will be around no matter where the cycles are. So, you know, sure. If we do have a downturn, these properties that you're now managing, especially if it's a third party, you got other clients other than yourself. You still can generate revenue from all of those sources as opposed to just going, oh man, you know, you're only dealing with your own in-house property. So
that's right. Absolutely. I mean, I am by nature, I am a deal junkie. So I love deals. And that is probably where sort of the impetus behind launching Peak 15 Capital came mm-hmm. from, is because I love deals so much, my own and other people's deals. I sort of launched a company just to satisfy that urge to some extent. It's hard to kind of say, like, I launched a whole company just to satisfy the urge of deals. But, you know, but it's true. It's, I'm not ashamed to say it. I love deals. And, again, you know, anything that has to do with deal making, the whole process of acquisition jazzes me up. So anything from the early due diligence, talking to brokers, to finding the right asset, to running the numbers on it, to, you know, walking the assets, to doing the due diligence early on, to scrubbing the numbers, and then obviously, you know, finding the right investor, the right capital, talking to the right capital, talking to the right investor, and then consummating a deal. That to me is pretty much what gets me up every morning. And that's really what drives me. And again, that's really one of the main reason why I launched Peak 15 Capital, because we weren't doing that on the other side. Right. On the, our other company, we just kind of stopped doing that, and we became a net seller, kind of had to retool. Again, going back to retooling, retooled ourselves completely. And in that retooling, I launched Peak 15 Capital. And really initially, Peak 15 Capital was working, still is. But we are at heart working with sponsors across the nation, not just in the Southeast, to find them the right capital, to find them the right equity. And I'm very hands-on myself just because I'm a sponsor myself. So I look in the lens of capital placement from the lens of a sponsor. I don't look at it just from the lens of a capital placement company. So the deal itself gets me really excited. I'd like to know about the underwriting. How did you arrive at these numbers? What got him? Because listen, at the end of the day, if I'm sold on the deal myself as a sponsor, then I'm going to have a much better, much easier time selling it to institutional investors and private equity investors to put their money into the deal. That's essentially what we started, sort of the whole premise behind Peak 15 Capital. And we've had a lot of clients. We got a lot of sponsors in the industry that have found us and come to us through either word of mouth or through my context in the industry. I do a lot of speaking engagements. So they've known me from either the speaking circles or the conference circuit or whatever. And, thank God we've had a great launch for the past, 10, 12 months. And I mean, we launched in the middle of a pandemic, and we are now growing to our, again, sort of next phase of growth. So it's been a blessing.
That's awesome. So you guys, you're not necessarily lending out just your own finances. You're more just, you're the middleman. People call you and say, hey, John, I'm trying, this is the deal, is the project. It's an amazing project, but I don't have the industry contacts or the people that can help me get this across the finish line. And so then you go out and shop it to your network, and then you plug the two together. Is that about right?
That's about right. Yeah. We shop it to our network of institutional and private equity investors, family offices, and then bring the right equity to the table. Sometimes if I like the deal enough, we would look at the deal to go in as a co-GP ourselves. Sure. So I'll put in my own name, my own money into the deal, but that doesn't always happen. That's, I would say maybe, 2 out of 10 that I might find a deal that I like that much, or it falls into the right area, or the numbers are right, where, I would put in my own name and actually go in as a co-GP. 80% of the time to 85% of the time it's just sponsors that I like and I love working with will come to us with deals that range anywhere between, let's call it 4 million to 20 million of equity that they need right into the deal. And we go out and find that for them.
What's the typical structure on something like that? So let's say you find the, they need, make it easy, 10 million bucks in equity, right? Like, what does the, because obviously a lot of us, if we're just doing straight syndications, we got the equity, we got the debt portion of it, right? And so is this equity that's coming in covering, they're covering up to a certain threshold of equity, but yet the sponsor still has to bring their own pile of money to the table, right?
Yeah, the sponsors still have to put in some skin in the game. Obviously, any equity source, institutional, private equity, family office, no matter what it is, they still expect the sponsor to have some kind of skin in the game and bring some skin in the game to the equation. And that could be, and that is essentially is figured out a part of the equity stack, equity capital stack. So you have your full capital stack that's comprised of equity and debt. Let's take out 70% on the average, 70 to 75% of debt out of the equation. That's going to be held, handled by the lender. Yep. 25 to 30% is going to be handled by the equity source. So out of that 30% equity, most sources will expect the sponsor to go in anywhere between 10 to 15%, at a 10% at a minimum to go in as part of that equity stack. So if they're raising, let's call it, we're raising a $5 million equity raise for someone, you know, 10% of that is 500,000. So the equity sources will probably bring in 90% of the equity to the table, but they still expect the sponsor to have their own 500 grand into the deal.
That makes deals a lot more doable. Like for maybe smaller shops, you know, if you can find an equity partner with 90% of the capital, that makes deals a lot more doable. But with that, I would imagine there's a price to that money. What does the 90% equity partner, what do they typically ask for on terms?
Well, you know, the price varies, and it doesn't necessarily have to be no cookie cutter straight up equation on this. I mean, they could be anything from, you know, sharing some of the fees, whether it's acquisition fees or asset management fees, whether it's, you know, going in on the promote, whether it's, you know, you've taken a good chunk of the promote and then splitting that. I mean, I don't want to give you exact numbers because there's no exact numbers that apply to everybody. Every deal is a negotiation. They give you a deal term and then you have to negotiate what you want and don't want out of it. Just keep in mind when you bring in someone who's bringing 90% of the equity to the table, you know,
they got some leverage.
They're going to have some leverage. So, you know, I'm constantly surprised sometimes of sponsors that are like floored that somebody's asking for them to split some fees with them or something. I'm like, dude, they're bringing 90% of the capital to you. You know, what did you expect? You
know, right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, that to me would seem like common sense. Like they're ponying up most of the risk here. So they're going to get compensated accordingly, one way or the other.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to get their pound of flesh. I'm sorry to tell you, but that's how it's built. I would do it. You would do it. You know, if you're putting, you know, $90 into a $100 deal, you'd want your pound of flesh out of that.
You want your pound of flesh? Yeah, I mean, not just that, you know, unreasonably, but it just makes sense. Also, the other thing that I think maybe what I'm hearing is that sponsors overlook is that they're getting a deal done that they may not otherwise have been able to get done.
100%. And look, it's for the most part, people sometimes get scared of involving institutional or private equity capital to the deal because they think they're going to lose, you know, they're going to lose all control of the deal and they're going to lose, you know, they're not going to make any money on it. That's the perception out there. It's like, we're never going to make money. You're going to make less money. Yes. You know, because again, as I said a little bit earlier, they're going to want to participate in the fees. They're going to participate in a promote. So you're going to make less than what you would have made if you just went out on your own and just raised money from, you know, country club money is what I'd call it, friends and family and, you know, accredited investors.
Sure.
So yeah, you will make a little bit less money in that, but think of the deal size that you're going to be able to attain. And also those investors they're not interested in bankrupting the equation. They're not interested in driving you to the ground because if you're not doing well, they're not going to do well.
Right.
If a sponsor is really stressed out and they're not going to make anything out of the deal, they know that they're not, that's not appropriate for them either. I mean, they don't want the sponsor to be starving. It's, you know, it's not a win-win situation if that's the case. So they want the sponsor to make money. They want the sponsor to feel like they're, you know, they're happy and content with the deal. And they're also motivated to make more money on the back end. So they want all that to happen because otherwise, why get into the deal? They're not in the business. These investors are not in the business of coming in and stealing the deal completely and bankrupting the sponsor. So, yeah.
Sure. No, I think all that's fascinating. And those are oftentimes things that we could overlook. One last question on Peak 15. Where does the name come from?
So Peak 15 is the typographical name of Mount Everest. That's what Mount Everest used to be called before it was called Mount Everest.
Ah, I learned something new today.
Yeah, Peak 15 was the sort of the descripting of what, you know, the topographers where they're calculating the height and distance and all that kind of stuff. Mount Everest back in the 1800s, they called it Peak 15.
Got it. Okay. Hey, that's really cool. I like that. Yeah. I learned a lot today. Hey, there we go. Let's jump here into the final four. What is one piece of advice you would give to an aspiring investor?
Don't be afraid to collaborate. Collaboration is key. Collaboration is king. Collaboration is what gets you to the next level.
Love that. What is one thing you are currently doing to stay on top of your game?
Stay informed. Stay connected. Read more. Don't just take things for granted. Read more, inform yourself, and not just from one source, from multiple sources.
Great, great. When it comes to giving back, what is one way you are making the world a better place?
Try to be involved in various organizations, both from a mentorship perspective, community giving perspective. I'm involved in, you know, a few different organizations. I sit on the board of a couple of organizations. So just try to stay involved and stay connected, stay tethered to what really matters in life, which is our humanity.
Right. No, I love that. That's great. That's great. John, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, how do they do that?
On LinkedIn, Instagram, they can email me at azar@peak15cap.com. That's azar, A-Z-A-R, at peak15cap.com. They can also, again, LinkedIn or my website, which is peak15cap.com.
Awesome. John, thanks so much for your time today. Certainly enjoyed it.
Of course. Thanks. Enjoyed it.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.